Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. Well, we've had a busy week, as always, in the health news arena. Of course, I try to select from the numerous stories out there, stories that I think will be of interest, either in terms of adding to what you've already learned, or expanding on a topic that we cover regularly, or even just something of interest. There's really so many options every week, and I find it an interesting task trying to whittle them down to things that are relevant. Here goes. So first up this week, sleep medications triple the risk of early death. Now, whether these are anti-anxiety type medications or sedative type medications, the risk was for increased mortality was 322%. This was a study of 14,000 people aged 18 to 102. So a lot of times with these studies, you know, you're looking at people over the age of 50 or 60. Where they're in the potential zone where they might have a problem. But this was all the way down to age 18, indicating that there was likely some issues with sleepiness and grogginess where accidents were caused or car accidents were caused, something of this sort. But the risk for, of 322% existed, especially when there were other coexisting lifestyle issues such as smoking, drinking, depression, this kind of stuff combined with these medications. That's typically when those medications are used, although a person could just be using the medications and not have any of these other problems. Well, then the risk is still a statistically significant 36%. But for most people, they have a cocktail of things going on instead of actually fixing their body. And this just goes to show you just can't pop these pills and think that, okay, I got to get some sleep, so I got to take a drug. That is very short-sighted management of health. It's a once-in-a-blue-moon sort of a thing for people. It shouldn't be on a regular basis that somebody's taking these things because they are not safe. They significantly increase the risk of early death, and that's now proven by a study. A related study, aerobic exercise cures insomnia. Now, this study was in older individuals, 55 and older. I guess that's old. I don't know. But 55 and older, that's who was being studied here. And they found that 40 minutes of aerobics four times per week was adequate to change these people from poor sleepers to good sleepers. you know, this is pretty amazing. Well, why does aerobics work? Well, of course, it's resetting the biological clock. It's getting them more in sync with the day so that then they can go to sleep better at night. Now, sometimes people with sleep problems, if they do aerobics too late in the day, they're going to have a problem. They'll find they'll wake up. That's because they're already so out of sync. So if you have a difficult sleep problem, you want to progressively do aerobics earlier in the morning. And you say, well, I'm too tired. I didn't sleep well. I don't have the energy to do aerobics. Those are not valid excuses. You'll find that if you drag your rear end out to do some aerobics and get yourself in gear, within 5 minutes, your energy systems come on. And if they don't, if you're really truly tired, fine, just go back and take a nap after you're done. And that eventually you'll get yourself back in sync and back in rhythm, and you'll actually start getting good responses to aerobics earlier in the day. Especially, I like it really just shortly after getting up for people with sleep problems, because it conditions the biological clock to go into sync with Earth's clock, which is, of course, the problem a person with a sleep problem is having. So that's a very significant finding, and it's just a matter of people doing it. Get out there and do some aerobics. And this wasn't even a whole lot of aerobics. 40 minutes, four times a week, that's, in my opinion, you know, a very basic, minimal amount of aerobic activity. Antibiotics proven to alter digestive flora. Well, I saw this study and, of course, couldn't help but publish it. This is the commonly prescribed antibiotic Cipro, one course of it is capable of disturbing the digestive contents even up to 6 months later. Not always, but it can. But when you get 5-day courses of Cipro within a 10-month period, it significantly disturbs the digestive balance. And it's very difficult to recover from. Well, that is not good news for Western medicine. Now, this is a subject that I've observed this in people since, you know, really the beginning of my career working in nutrition, because way back in the 1980s, I was heavily involved with working with individuals with candida albicans and yeast overgrowth and food allergies and whatnot. And the point being is we always saw that, well, sometimes a young child or anyone would recover from one dose of antibiotics, but usually by the time they were down to the second one, there's a major problem of health here, which means, first of all, that both parents and individuals need strategies to help prevent the use or need for antibiotics, which means act more aggressively with your immune support nutrients before you get into the theoretical need for these. Now, this is not that impossible to do. Mary and I raised all four of our kids, not once, through living in our home and up to the age of 18 years of age, did any of them take an antibiotic because they had gotten sick. And that's because when they would get something, they were boosted up with nutrition and allowed to fight it. And of course, you know, if they'd ever gotten really sick, I would not have hesitated to get them an antibiotic. I mean, I'm not, you know, I understand when antibiotics would be appropriate and that sometimes they're needed, but the kids never got to that point. So, you know, it's very possible for people to work aggressively with nutrition to help bolster the immune system for themselves and for their children. And that gives you a window of opportunity to not have to go to these antibiotics, which can have long-term effects on the balance of the digestive tract, which can create lifelong health problems. That's the point of this, is that once the balance of power is altered and bad gangs have taken up residence in the neighborhoods of your digestive tract, you are in for trouble. And the trouble may ebb and flow based on various factors, such as how much sleep you get and how well you eat and how much sugar you don't eat and these kind of things, but they don't really go away. And they tilt your system into a more inflammatory condition. They tilt your gut into a situation of making more toxic waste products, which not only interfere with digestion and interfere with the health in your digestive tract, but also go back into your body and cause health problems elsewhere. And these things are very significant factors. Now, the medical profession has convinced themselves that antibiotic courses are just routine and they're really not a problem, and the only real problem is that they might develop antibiotic resistance at some point, and so they're trying to cut down on their use. But this is a different concept. This is advanced molecular technology doing, you know, repeated stool analysis, up to 50 stool analyses on individuals over a period of a year or 10 months. And the point being is they're really analyzing for the first time the subpopulations of flora that exist. This technology was not available until recently. So, you know, this whole argument that I've been having with the medical profession for the past 20 years about how much damage they're doing to the ecological system of the digestive tract with the antibiotics, which is self-evident, is now proven by science and not a trivial issue. And it just goes to show that doctors giving out antibiotics, especially on a repeated basis, are putting the patients at long-term health risk, especially if they don't take steps to correct it. So any person should minimally take acidophilus, at least one bottle, for a month or so after antibiotics to help their system get back on track. And if they already have existing digestive symptoms or they worsen with the antibiotics, then they may need to do more things than acidophilus to get back on track. But even if you don't think you have symptoms following the use of antibiotics, you still should do it just to, because it's clear that the digestive balance of power is stressed and strained and altered from even one dose, and your system may not bounce back completely even if you don't have symptoms. So, you know, it's just some clear science showing the extreme danger of using repetitive antibiotics. And so you want to stay out of that rut or that potential problem with your health, especially with the health of a child. Because, you know, remember, in a child, one of their main goals as a youngster is evolving an immune system and a digestive balance of power. Those are two of the most important things to a child's health from ages birth through five. And if you're pumping in antibiotics for repeating ear infections or something, you've got a major issue on your hands. And you need to do something much more effective than just go down that path, which you do have options. All right. Is insulin resistance a defense against low-grade bacterial infection? Well, this opens up a whole new area of inquiry. And this is just what I consider to be most likely the first study on of this type. What actually the study was researchers took healthy individuals and they inserted into them bacterial endotoxin. Now, endotoxin, which is also known as LPS or lipopolysaccharide, that's the sheathing off of the cell membrane of gram-negative bacteria. It is considered to be an incredibly toxic byproduct of bacterial infection. So just to put this in the context, a tremendous amount of scientific research is done daily, yearly, on the effects of lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, or endotoxin, on metabolism. In other words, it's considered to be a standardized toxin for scientific exploration and is routinely used for various purposes in tests and whatnot. So it's, this is very mainstream in terms of what we're talking about here. And the researchers here were trying to figure out the effect of insulin in helping to reduce the potential septic shock of a large dose of this LPS or endotoxin. And what they found was that, indeed, insulin levels were elevated in response to the toxic insult. And, in fact, the insulin levels actually helped to, in some way, which they didn't figure out the mechanism, but they figured that it was happening, that the insulin was actually helping to neutralize the endotoxin. Well, that means that insulin can double as a defense system against poison during acute infection. And that's probably some kind of a survival mechanism. I mean, if you think about it and you're sitting there with a nasty infection and your metabolism is needing food and you have to eat to support your life, well, you're going to raise insulin. And if you're raising insulin in the midst of an acute infection and it was somehow immunosuppressive or something, then you'd, get worse. So, our bodies have it figured out that as you're eating and insulin's going up, well, insulin better might as well do something else useful in this context. So it somehow has evolved to help clear the lipopolysaccharide endotoxin of bacterial infection. It just makes survival common sense. We also know, for example, from earlier studies that LDL cholesterol does the same thing, helps protect against endotoxin. So whether, some of these issues where we have elevated LDL cholesterol or elevated insulin, which is kind of the metabolic picture of somebody going into the metabolic syndrome, which is associated with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, this path towards cardiovascular disease. Well, maybe, just maybe, some of the things that are tilting a person in this direction are actually a defense mechanism against a low-grade ongoing bacterial infection. Well, where would you have those? Well, the most common places are your mouth and your digestive tract. So if you, for example, based on my last news posting, if you get your gut imbalanced from antibiotics, now you have hostile bacteria in your digestive tract, which is common, you're going to make excess lipopolysaccharide. We know, for example, that individuals who are overweight do, in fact, have extra lipopolysaccharides circulating in their digestive tract. I mean, excuse me, in their circulation. We already know this. It's a common finding. And now we're getting all the links showing, well, maybe, just maybe, the insulin is going up, not entirely just because of bad eating. I mean, that will, of course, cause it, but because it's being going up to help defend against the toxicity of a low-grade infection. So my point here for people is that if you have a problem with your blood sugars and you're either type 2 diabetic or heading that direction, you want to rule out digestive infections, mouth infections, any other kind of infection, and get them under control, because that may enable your insulin level then to go back down, the insulin resistance to fix itself. So I think this is the cutting, leading edge announcement in this regards. I don't know of anybody else who's talking about this, but I think it's a very valid point, and I think we'll see a lot more scientific research on this in the future, but it just means that there's more angles to the metabolic problem than just, you know, calories in and exercise. And there's all these aspects of metabolic efficiency, and it's not just metabolic efficiency relating, say, to the five rules of the leptin diet and how well your thyroid works and all this kind of stuff. It's, is your body causing you a problem with insulin because it's actually defending you from an infection? And so this is kind of an interesting concept, but it does open the door for some people who may be stuck with their metabolism to kind of analyze some of these other areas that may actually be at the root cause. Yes, and here we have another study. Common virus linked to obesity. Now this is very interesting research that's going on. The virus is called the adenovirus 36. Now there are a number of adenoviruses. I think there's about 50 different ones. So number 36 is just one of the 50. But it's this particular virus, the adenovirus 36, that has the research interest peaked. One of the main researchers in this field, his name is Atkinson. I actually heard him speak. I was myself speaking to an obesity conference back about 2005, and he was the presenter just before me. I was speaking on leptin and addiction and food problems, and he was speaking on this adenovirus 36. He was one of the lead pioneers in this field. And his interest, you know, so I've had an interest in following up on this. What I found most fascinating about his conversation back then is that the adenovirus 36 effect, see, it actually seems to reside in fat. It takes up its residence in white adipose tissue. So, for example, the adenovirus 36, as part of the adenovirus family, causes upper respiratory infections, ear infections, conjunctivitis, swollen throat stuff can be involved with it, strep throat-like stuff. In other words, this adenovirus 36 is common. Adenoviruses cause about 10% of the upper respiratory infections in children. And, of course, as I'm saying here, this particular strain of adenovirus is one of 50, and I'm not sure how much it is, how much of it there is relative to the other 50, but there's obviously some of it. So it is a common infection. And once you're over the infection, as with many viral infections, they oftentimes take up residence in the human body in some place. In other words, the voice box is a common place for viral infections, as well as the liver. And they kind of live in a subclinical state, meaning they're not actually making you feel like you're sick, but they're actually causing problems to your body. And the adenovirus 36 takes up residence in your white adipose tissue. And once it's in there, it knocks out leptin production. So that's one of the hallmarks of what it's doing. So it's actually knocking out leptin production. In the traditional concept of leptin resistance, you have the situation where somebody who's overweight is making way too much leptin. It's not getting into the brain. This is more similar to the little mouse that doesn't make any leptin at all. This is kind of a viral-induced inability to produce leptin, which is, you know, kind of the same net result as leptin resistance, because leptin doesn't get into your brain, so you eat too much. But the problem with this virus is that it's not only knocking out leptin, it's actually stimulating the production of new fat cells to store fat while at the same time preventing them from breaking down fat. So in the study that was just released, they had a group of 124 children with antibodies present to the AD, and some of them had the antibodies present to the adenovirus 36. Actually, 19 of the 124 children tested positive, and 15 of those kids were obese. And they weren't just a little obese. These were the kids that were 50 pounds obese. You know, they weighed 50 more pounds than the average child. So we're talking about something that has the potential to really cripple leptin function, to really cripple white adipose tissue health. and to induce serious obesity. So this could be especially a problem if somebody is eating normally and gaining weight, especially if it's a child. And so now, there are no studies as to this point on how to deal with this, so in other words, if you went and killed this virus, could fat recover? Well, I'm guessing it might be able to. I'm certainly hoping it would be able to. I mean, the human body has a tremendous ability to bounce back. But essentially, this virus within fat is a huge, huge health problem. And it is affecting seemingly 1 in 5 obese children may actually have this a problem, which would obviously mean 1 in 5 obese adults. If we're going to extrapolate, that's probably the case. So this is a huge issue. If it's suspected, I would try antivirals. You know, we've got lots of products in that category. And I would see then if by taking antiviral nutrition, metabolism seems to improve. It's certainly worth a try. As far as blood tests go, I mean, if you do have AD36 or adenovirus 36 antibiotics tested for, that's fine, but just keep in mind that does not mean that you have a problem. It just means that your immune system has seen that as a problem in the past. Whether or not that's actually gotten into your white adipose tissue, even if you're obese, is unknown. However, if you do have low blood levels of leptin with elevated AD36, adenovirus 36 antibodies, then you probably do have the problem because the adenovirus 36 is knocking out the ability to make leptin. Most people who are overweight would have high leptin levels in their blood. So low leptin in the levels with, a significant obesity and a stuck metabolism and these antibodies would kind of paint the picture that you were having a problem with this. But just simply not doing the blood test, there'd be no reason why anybody couldn't just use some antivirals as an angle on the weight issue and see if it helps. But this study with viruses and these other studies with bacteria show that, and previous studies say with Candida albicans, like with Candida, we know that it actually generates anti-metabolic signals that communicate to the human system. And so we see that whether it's bacteria, virus, Candida, all of these things, especially on chronic low-grade situations, are anti-metabolites that will easily foul up metabolism and contribute to obesity. So it's a very interesting immunological perspective on the obesity epidemic, and it certainly applies to many, 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 many people who are struggling with weight issues as part of their problem. There is no question that it is part of the problem. All right, the FDA management escapes culpability for Avandia debacle. Well, I've been following this Avandia story now for 5 years, ever since it really broke into the major media when Stephen Nissen at the Cleveland Clinic published a scientific study showing that Avandia increased the risk of heart attacks by 40%. And, of course, he was strong-armed by GlaxoSmithKline not to induce or produce such data or do the report. He did it anyway. Turns out he was right. And now, finally, after all of these years, the FDA has highly restricted the sale of Avandia in the United States to a diabetes drug of last resort. And the European officials acting simultaneously with the FDA have banned it from Europe entirely. Now, you might say, well, why didn't they ban it from the United States entirely? The answer is extremely simple. In the United States, the FDA acts to protect the drug companies from legal liability. So when they ban something entirely, that's an open and shut legal case now for a flood of lawsuits. By leaving it on the market in a very narrow way, it creates a reasonable, tiny little doubt, and it makes it much more difficult for individuals to win a legal case. So what the FDA strategy isn't so much to have this as a remedy of last resort for diabetic patients. That's ridiculous. The reason is to minimize, to save the drug company potentially several $1 billion in what will absolutely be a flood of lawsuits relating to individuals who were taking this and had heart attacks, which you can assume will be quite a few people. Now, There's several important things to understand about this, because the media isn't covering them today. They're just talking about how the FDA has curtailed sales of this. But it's actually, the FDA is completely responsible for this entire problem, because the FDA safety scientists knew and put a black box warning on this drug back in 2006. So the safety supervisor of the Avandia trials, her name was Dr. Rosemary Johann Leong. She actually put a slapped a black box warning on it for congestive heart failure back in March of 2006. And then the former FDA commissioner, Andrew von Eschenbach, one of the worst FDA commissioners, it's hard to say that one is worse than another, but certainly one of the most big pharma-friendly ones, his management team, had her retract the approval and then stripped her of her power to make such warnings and removed her from the safety, the FDA's review of Avandia. So then the FDA approved Avandia. It went on to the market. Its sales skyrocketed to $3.2 billion while the FDA didn't say a darn word about it. And then Stephen Nissen published his findings, and then others started publishing their findings, and then Congress said, what the heck is going on here? So they call the FDA in, and now the FDA starts to say, well, we're going to take a look at this. The FDA goes into damage control mode. You got to understand here, the FDA is more interested in covering its own image and its own problems than it is at public safety. So they're not interested here. This is 3 years ago. They weren't interested in taking it off the market then, because that would have just smacked themselves with a bad PR problem, and GlaxoSmithKline with huge lawsuits. So they dragged their feet for 3 years, 4 years, until now, when they finally, in the face of overwhelming evidence, curtail the sales of the drug significantly. But by now, the legal liability has lessened. Andrew von Eschenbach has gotten out of Dodge, and numerous Americans lie dead. And it's not a joke. I'm not trying to make light of this. They killed numerous Americans. We don't know the exact number, but it's a lot of people. Normal, this would be called manslaughter. Okay, in the world of big pharma and the FDA, this is business as usual. Business as usual. But this is intentional. The FDA did this on purpose to American citizens. And it is my opinion that Andrew von Eschenbach and the management team at the FDA should be hauled into court and should have to fight manslaughter charges, because they killed Americans knowingly for the profits of Big Pharma. And they might as well haul GlaxoSmithKline executives in at the same time, because they certainly knew what was going on. And the data was obvious. And I did an article not too long ago on the DHA versus Avandia and the Actos, which is still on the market, same class of drug, explaining exactly why these things cause heart disease. So this isn't rocket science. It's more complicated than the average person wants to know, but it's understandable if you want to follow up on this. But this is a huge, huge story. I don't understand why the news media, whether it's from the right or from the left, won't cover this stuff properly. You've got only a few reporters. The New York Times, which is a left-wing newspaper, Gardner, whatsoever his name is, he's actually one of the best writers on this kind of stuff. He actually exposes it. Gardner Harris, I think his name is. Yeah, he's a pretty good writer at the New York Times. He's written a number of big pharma expose articles. So that's coming from the left, but you'd think the right would be even more interested in this, especially, of course, now that we have the problem with the health bills and what that all means to everyone. But this is how can you clean up the costs of health care when you have criminal activity willfully injuring Americans? You know, you got the right saying, well, we got to curtail lawsuits. Well, that's fine if you have normal things going on. But what happens when you have a drug company and the FDA actively co-conspiring to sell drugs and injure Americans? How can you cut legal liability for something like that? The only way that's ever going to get cut and not be part of the healthcare system is if big pharma executives and their co-conspirators at the FDA go to jail when this stuff is found out about. Then they'll quit doing it. But otherwise, it's just part of the cost of business. In other words, Big Pharma does intentional, illegal, off-label marketing of drugs they know injure, and they just set aside a certain amount of money, and they build it into the cost of the product so that the taxpayers who are paying for the drugs and the insurance companies and Medicare and Medicaid who are paying for these drugs, they're actually paying for future Big Pharma litigation against these drugs that the drug companies know are dangerous, and this is how this game is played. I think this is just unbelievable travesty against the people in this country, and something that somebody is going to have to do something about sooner or later, and hopefully sooner, because you know, we're really entering into a health care delivery crisis time, and having all of these drug scams on top of a system of health delivery certainly doesn't make matters easier to deal with. Okay, let's see here. On a lighter note, physical activity reduces the risk for genetic obesity proneness. Okay, so this is a study with some 20,000 individuals, British researchers, ages of the participants, age 39 to 79, and they did some detail analyzing gene variants, which are known to be associated with obesity. And this is interesting, you know, because we all have little genetic quirks. I mean, this isn't anything unusual. You know, there are certain people, you know, and they sit and they can eat anything and they never gain a pound. And we all go, how can you do that? And they've got some beneficial genetic quirks. Then you got people who more easily gain weight than others. And apparently, the more of these gene variants you have, the easier it is for you to gain weight. Well, what these researchers found was that one or more or greater than 1 hour of either demanding physical work activity or on purpose, you know, strenuous exercise per week reduced your risk of becoming overweight by 40%. Now, that's actually really dramatic. And what this means is that if when you do physical exercise, you turn genes on that are healthy. And if you turn them on enough, it offsets other weaknesses that you have to the point where now you're going to be okay. And that's really good news, once again, because a lot of us will have these gene weaknesses. We don't know who we all are. I'm not an advocate for genetic profiling, but it's kind of obvious you might have a problem if you're gaining weight too easily, even eating the right amount of food. So extra exercise can, if you have a family history and you don't want to end up like somebody else in your family, well, you know, exercise. And it'll help reduce your risk of that happening, along with other good lifestyle choices. But that's encouraging science showing a different reason to exercise. In other words, it's not just to burn calories or to be more fit. It's to turn on genes that strengthen metabolic processes, which is what exercise tends to do. And this is proof of that. All right. Let's see what else we have here. Ah, yes. It is a lack of DHA linked to Alzheimer's disease. And this is an interesting story. I mean, most of us understand that DHA is good for the brain. And there's a lot of data to show, you know, explain how DHA is built into brain cells and whatnot. But this is where researchers are doing autopsies on cadavers of people who have had Alzheimer's, and even they know to what degree they had Alzheimer's and how much trouble they had with Alzheimer's. And the researchers found the key reason, the key brain regions that are involved with cognitive function. They found that the brain cells in these key regions were lacking DHA in direct proportion to the amount of Alzheimer or cognitive deficit problem the person was having. So as the DHA levels in the brain go down, the risk for cognitive problems go up. This is, you know, an interesting form of proof, meaning we're going to look at people after they died, we're going to analyze their brain tissues, and we're going to see how much DHA is actually in there. And then unexpectedly, they found that the same people who had the worst Alzheimer also had liver defects in producing DHA. So, in other words, DHA is a very long fatty acid. It has a lot of, you know, it has the carbon skeleton, and then you have the shorter, you know, it's a 24 carbon skeleton, then you have the shorter 18 carbon skeletons of, say, alpha linolenic acid. This is the kind of omega-3 oil that's found in, say, vegetables like salad or lettuce or grass or something. So, for example, when a cow eats grass, then the animal's digestive system converts the alpha-linolenic acid into DHA. And then that DHA will be part of the dairy products of that animal or the meat of that animal. And that's kind of how that works. The other source of DHA that's already made in the food supply is fish, you know, salmon, tuna, that kind of stuff, deep sea fish, cold water fish. And so those are the food sources of DHA. Otherwise, if you're eating mostly vegetables, then you have to convert the shorter length omega-3 oils into the longer length omega-3 oils. And so something like flax oil or some vegetable source of omega-3 is not DHA. It has to be elongated. That takes zinc. It takes vitamin B6. It takes a process. It's not necessarily even efficient. Well, what they found was that in these Alzheimer's patients, it just wasn't even working, that process of elongating the fatty acids. These people had a defect in their liver. Well, that's not good news. That's who's getting the Alzheimer's. So the moral of the story is take or eat DHA because you don't have to produce it from those shorter length oils, but you certainly have to have it. And the easiest, safest way to make sure you're having it is to be consuming it. So that's an important study. And I'm not saying DHA is the only thing involved with Alzheimer, but DHA is a basic raw material for brain cells. In other words, it's like 2x4s and plywood for a house. DHA for brain cells is needed to construct them. And so it's a fundamental thing that it's very clear here that if you don't have enough of it in your brain cells, you're way higher at risk for cognitive malfunction and Alzheimer's. So just one more reason to keep a steady flow of DHA going into your body. All right, that will do it for the news stories this past week. Let's go to your questions and see what they happen to be. First one comes from Roxanne, who says, a local nutrition show recommends eating 5 to 6 times a day, at the minimum 3 meals and 2 snacks. They say this is to keep your blood sugar balanced throughout the day and to boost metabolism. They explain that if you have high triglycerides, it is due to eating too many carbohydrates, which then get converted into triglycerides. Eating more often reduces carbs and always include a protein and a fat. If you always include a protein and a fat, that would therefore reduce triglycerides. They believe that you do not want your liver to be forced to release glucose, but that we should provide our bodies with the energy it needs throughout the day. The 3 meals, 2 snacks is also what Weight Watchers recommended to my husband over 15 years ago. I myself have been following the leptin plan of 3 meals a day for years, love it, and would not change. I have low triglycerides and excellent HDL. What are your thoughts on this? Well, Roxanne, this is cuts to the point of what is wrong with the great majority of nutrition experts, diet experts on this planet. This is a huge point of contention between myself and the regular people out there. Now, if you stop and think about it, of course, if you're rampantly overeating and you cut back on the total number of calories, even if you're eating and snacking and stuff, you're probably going to improve simply by eating less food. But let's go to the point you're making in this thing, that they say that this is to keep your blood sugar balanced throughout the day and to boost metabolism. That's just malarkey. Your body naturally balances its own blood sugar by releasing what it ate. It stores sugar after the meal in your liver, and then it releases the sugar and simultaneously burns fat. You cannot burn any fat when you eat. You raise insulin. You can't burn fat when you're raising insulin. So eating too often tends to leave broken down calories in your circulation, which just makes it harder for anyone and everyone to lose weight. This notion that you don't want to force your liver to release glucose, that's insane. That's just absolutely insane. That's normal. It's normal that your liver would release glucose, and that's how your liver actually burns fat. So whoever is talking here, it's just nonsense. The Weight Watchers, when it has success, it's just simply because it got somebody to eat less food. It's still not the easiest way of doing it. And it's very clear that I am completely correct about this. And I've, of course, this is a very, you know, generic explanation, but I've documented all of this in Mastering Leptin and on numerous articles on my website. So that's what I think about that. Rick wants to know, do you believe in the principle of food combining as presented in the natural hygiene philosophy of eating? The answer, Rick, is no, I do not believe in that. It is incredibly easy for your body to digest carbohydrates, proteins, and fats simultaneously. This has never been a challenge. As soon as you start chewing on food, your body produces digestive enzymes in your saliva that begin the digestion of carbohydrates. And so the ability to digest carbohydrates simultaneously while digesting protein and beginning to mechanically break up fats and proteins in your stomach, that's all normal. Now, yes, I have seen people swear by food combining. And I look at it this way, Rick. When you have the flu and you're sick, about all you feel like eating is, you know, some saltines and soup. And you might feel like eating that way for a couple of days because your digestive system just really doesn't feel like eating very much. It's not doing so well. Likewise, when your digestive system is really out of whack, maybe it poses a challenge for it to do normal digestion. And so, in a flared-up condition or in a state of disrepair, some individuals may find that by eating one food at a time or not mixing this, that, or the other, it's easier for them to digest food. Fine. That's okay. That's a remedy. That doesn't mean it's a principle of health. It just means it can be used, if needed, if it even works for somebody, to help them through a tougher time of flu-like inability to digest food. And that's all fine. But to insinuate that that is somehow normal or natural or essential to health is absolutely mistaken, completely wrong, and a totally useless point of view. Rachel says, how much vitamin D should a person take in the winter? Well, I suggest in general a minimum of 1,200 units of vitamin D in the winter. A lot of people will need much more, but 1,200 units or 2,000 units is what I would recommend to anyone. And if you have a concern or an issue really wondering about vitamin D, I think it's easy. If you, for example, are struggling with catching bugs too easily, we're not feeling good in the winter, you can easily take more vitamin D as a variable up to 5,000 units just to see if it helps you. I mean, if it doesn't help you with something tangible, then I wouldn't take more than 2,000 units, unless, of course, you have a blood test showing that your vitamin D levels are low. Ideally, through the winter, you'd like to keep them in the two-thirds to three-fourths of the way up the normal range in terms of a blood test. But vitamin D lacking in the winter can cause heart attacks, which are common later in the winter as vitamin D levels really go down, and certainly make you more at risk for infections. And so vitamin D adequacy would be far more common sense than, say, a flu shot for protection from infection and much safer for you. So I think it's an important question, and thank you for sending it in. Okay, Shirley wants to know, when taking the extra sorts of supplements, I'm always wondering just how much of each I need, and does this also relate to one's age? Would it be possible for you to put out a chart with this info, for example, how much fish oil, panethene, etc. should a person take? Well, Shirley, that is a good question. It more so than relating to one's age, the amount one might take of something relates to one's need. And let's just take fish oil, for example. If you have, for example, anywhere from 500 milligrams of DHA up to 1,000 milligrams of DHA, you have a very good basic health-promoting level of DHA. Now, that's not the same as the milligrams of fish oil. DHA is usually 10 to 15% of fish oil supplements, or even naturally, say, in salmon, whereas, you know, some of, like, what we use, the molecularly distilled DHA, it's up to 50% DHA in terms of the oil amount. But you want to look at the DHA amount, not just the fish oil amount. Now, you could benefit from higher doses if you're overweight or if you have cardiovascular concerns. In fact, you could go as high as 2,000 or 3,000 units of DHA And you'd want to notice, one, that your metabolism was working better in the case of body weight, and two, that your blood pressure is good or better, and that your triglyceride levels are better if you're having these cardiovascular problems. So higher levels may be very beneficial. Now, the complexity in this is that it's always different for every vitamin. So a chart might be a good thing for me to consider in the future on this. Surely it will just take some time to write such a chart. In the meantime, if you look at any of the product description sheets that we have on our website for just about any nutrient, you'll see what the range is there, and you'll see what the result is you're supposed to be getting for a particular kind of nutrient. And if you work, you know, you can start out with a lower amount, that's fine, but if you work a little bit higher, you'll see that, you know, hopefully you get the result that you're intending to get from taking something for a particular reason. So with Pantothene, yeah, it might be to help manage your cholesterol, but it's also good for your energy and your mood and clear-headed thinking and that kind of stuff. It has a lot of advantages. And so it goes with every nutrient. Most of the nutrients do have therapeutic levels that have been used in clinical studies, and those we usually try to explain to people, and that's pretty much it in a nutshell. I know that doesn't specifically answer your question for every nutrient, but the information is available at this point as a general overview. I don't have a chart, but I like your question here. I think I'm going to try to put one together at some point in the not too far off future, try to make it a little bit easier for everyone. All right, Ellen says, I feel better eating when I am traveling in Italy and France compared to seemingly the same foods in the United States. Do you think their food is better in general? Well, yes. And that's a problem with our food supply. I think one of the things about Italy and France is their cultures and how they actually rely on the freshness of food as a concept. So in the United States, you are often eating grains that are 2 and 3 years old because they've been stored and they're rotating crops in and out. And what happens when these grains sit in large storage bins, they grow mold on top of them. And you actually start to developing increased levels of fungal poison. This is not really regulated very well at all. And then as the grains are sent to market, all the fungus that's been growing on the top of them is just mixed in with them. And then, and plus the stuff's like 2 years old half the time. Well, in France and Italy, you've got the same kinds of foods going straight to the market. And you're eating from the last year's crops. And it's much fresher food. It has much more life vitality in it. It has much less fungal toxin in it. And I think this makes a huge difference into the quality of food and the quality of health for a citizenry. So I don't think it's your imagination, Ellen. I think what you're saying is fact. John wants to know, what is better for weight loss, aerobics, or strength training? There seems to be a number of different schools of thought on this. And I would have to agree with you. There's plenty of different schools of thought on this. I don't think it's an open or shut case, John. I think if I'm going to rank it, if I was forced to choose one over the other, I'd probably pick aerobics, but it's really not the issue of choosing one over the other. I'd say it's probably aerobics 55%, strength training 45% in terms of the importance of one next to the other, and maybe even in terms of about how much time you spend on each of them. Aerobics burns fat, metabolizes fat. As you do longer aerobics, fat is the primary fuel that sustains aerobics, and if you're not overeating, then aerobics is going to dispose of fat quite efficiently, especially if you're getting a good response to aerobic exercise. Strength training has the ability to build up the amount of muscle you have, which means then you'll have more mitochondria per muscle fiber. You'll actually increase the number of car engines you have at rest. So if you have a 4-cylinder resting car engine and you do more strength, now you have an 8-cylinder resting car engine, you're obviously going to burn more fuel, i.e. gas, i.e. calories, even sitting still. Both types of exercise turn on genes that help metabolism differently. So you're conditioning the fitness of metabolism differently with both types of exercise, but both of them are very positive. And if you don't do one and you're just doing the other, you're not going to get that more broad benefit. So I think rather than saying one is a lot better than the other, it's probably important to make the point, John, that they're both fantastic, and whatever kind of a program you do, mixing them together for yourself is probably terrific, and it's much more of an issue that people do them than not do them than to worry about which one is necessarily better than the other, as both are very important. Okay, that's it for your questions this week. If you have a question, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. And everyone, please have a healthy, happy week. And I'll be back, of course, next week with more news and questions to help you out on your quest for health. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update Podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.